Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema.
So when we left off the conversation in part one, it quite neatly sort of stopped just before you got married and you left for Australia. So just for our listeners who haven't perhaps had the opportunity of reading that second volume, Time Flies 2, T-00, can you fill us in on what that process was like?
It was pretty simple. Once I decided to do it, I did it, and doing it was involved resigning from the company that I'd worked with for 13 years, which was most of my adult life, and talking to my ex-wife and my children, and packing suitcases, and then in typical Virgin style, Richard threw this enormous party. It was done with such style and thoroughness that one could almost suspect it was welcome, but it was a party. It was a party to say goodbye, and it was wonderful, absolutely wonderful. I mean, it was, if you're going to say goodbye to a country and to a company and to people who have been dear to you for all those years, then that's the way to do it. Invite everyone that you're still talking to and hope that somebody will pay the bill. And thankfully they did.
And so you're still in contact with Richard Branson, right?
Yes. Yeah. When he comes to Australia, we see each other. And when he doesn't come to Australia, we correspond occasionally.
That must be, because you are an important part of Virgin's success, and certainly it's the way it broadened into film. You were a key figure there.
I think I was a balancing agent. I think one of Virgin's great skills in employing people, for the most part, was that there was no model for the perfect employee. It was all about creating a team of people, all of whom had disparities in some ways, but whose desires for the company and hard work and self-application was unswerving. So it turned out to be a very good team of people without it having, I think, any conscious design behind it.
How did you see the film? So you're going on to this new adventure in Australia. And how did you see the film industry as was in Australia at that time? I mean, it's with some notable exceptions, it's not, you know, as bubbling maybe as the one you were leaving.
It felt a little procedural. I mean, one is always appreciative of any kind of government or tax incentive that enables films and television to be made. But I found that in any situation in which the process is kind of formalized and applications are made, and of course boxes get ticked both literally and metaphorically, that there can be a slightly mechanical air to the process, and that lighting a fire underneath yourself is really one of the things that one of the driving forces of making movies, and then lighting it under a few other people as well. So I mean, curiously, one of the first things I did on arrival was attend a conference on the Gold Coast where a lot of producers especially attended. And I felt there was a great kind of optimism and buoyancy, but I felt that it was a little procedural as well.
You're able to bring in a sort of outsider's view and sort of disrupt the scene to some degree. What were the first projects that you started working on when you got to Australia? Did you have something already to sort of step into as soon as you got there?
No, I joined a company because around the time I was getting married, I met all the principals and I decided to marry them. No, I didn't. I decided to join this company, which assured me that part of its intent in the late 1980s was to make movies as well as television. They were already doing television, and I was reluctant to move into that field, which has never interested me particularly. Except, you know, the more esoteric stuff. But as a whole, it's film on which I felt informed at that stage on a world scale, and film which I felt was the missing element in the company. And clearly they did too. So they asked me to join them specifically to develop and eventually produce movies for theatrical release. And yeah, it sounds a little like a kind of fishing expedition, but I was sufficiently familiar with the Australian directors whom I thought were of interest or could become so. And so I just met them all, basically. There weren't that many, but there was a whole sequence of them who one by one visited me, or I them. And I felt by the end of that I was educated in who they were and what the aspirations were.
One of the pleasures of reading the second volume of your autobiography is that you're meeting a lot of these Australian stars and specifically the acting talent as well, although also directors. Andrew Dominic, for instance, is someone who makes his debut film with you, who aren't stars yet. And so you sort of see them coming up and see that progress happening. I'm thinking of Guy Pearce in Priscilla, making the step from television into movies. Russell Crowe, of course, also as an early film with you.
Yeah, well, George Ogilvy, who directed The Crossing, which was the first film I did in Australia, really found Russell. Well, he and the casting director, Faith Martin, had him on a list, and he showed up late one afternoon with partially missing tooth, knocked them all out. So George called me that evening and said, I think I found one of the three leads for The Crossing, because the three lead actors were all young and therefore probably little known. And so he had found two of them already. And the missing one was in a way the crucial one, because he helps generate the conflict. And and Russell just immediately, well, generated the conflict.
He's absolute, yeah. I was wondering as well, because The Crossing, Priscilla, they're all these, they're all quite ensemble films. And there's a film you do later on that you refer to as a sort of Priscilla with heterosexual guys. Do you think that's maybe a feature of sort of Australian cinema? You don't have a one big star that you can sort of carry a film, so you have to you tell more ensemble stories.
Well, if the star's character name is in the title, as in Mad Max, you need one, or one who's going to become one pretty quickly.
Yes.
Or else no franchise for you.
Right.
But yes, I wouldn't say that there was any particular conscious attraction for an ensemble in this case. But it's set in a small town. The three characters, all of them in their late teenage years, who create the combustion that leads to the fire, as it were. So you have to, unless somebody is carrying the film through their personal charisma, you actually need to look as broadly as that, and think about the symmetry and the chemistry and the compatibility.
So after The Crossing, and you come into doing Priscilla, which is the, I was interested to read about the making of that, because it's always interesting to read about a success which nobody really knows is going to be a success, and how all this, all the elements that you think of, or I think of as a viewer, as being sort of nailed on, such as Terence Stamp's performance, for instance, are actually the end product of a long process of trial and error, and that he was a particularly difficult role to cast, the role of Bernadette, I should say.
Yes. Well, we knew that from the start, that it would be difficult to cast that role, because it requires an actor of a certain age, and actors of that certain age are often more comfortable with doing whatever it is they've been doing for their acting careers up to that point. It was Terence who decided that he was ready for it, or at least a friend of his who persuaded him that he was. And he threw himself right into it. It was extraordinary. Because Terence was a very kind of masculine presence. When you saw him in his London environment, there was, apart from his, his great beauty as a young man, it was a man who wore brogues rather than tennis shoes.
I mean, you quite rightly point out, though, that you'd sort of seen something in him in terms of also the Pasolini movies that he was in, Theorem, that, there is even at the height of his fame in the 60s, an ambivalence or an ambiguity to his...
Well, he was so incredibly handsome, and he was photographed like a god. If you look at even his little known American Western Blue, in which I think he replaced Robert Redford, his hair is dyed blonde, and improbably he plays a half Mexican, but when the camera is on him, it practically defies you not to pay attention. There are many actors for whom that is not the case. So he had been kind of canonized in a way as a young man, which made his practical disappearance in the 1970s, in other words, after that burst of fame that began with, Far From the Madding Crowd and Billy Budd and so on. There was a long gap until he then later in the 70s appeared in Superman, which gave him a new kind of lease of life as a as a screen villain. But the fact is that he was perfect. And when he stepped off that plane from Hawaii and told me he had every hair plucked from his body, I thought, now there's a guy who knows how to get off to a good start.
I also love the fact in sort of an alternative universe that you offered Brian Brown the part, because Brian Brown is like, for my generation, is the Australian actor, you know.
We had such fun with Priscilla. I mean, that's one of the reasons I think the film ended up giving as much pleasure as it did, is that we were having such a great time from the start, long before we started shooting it. We treated it all very lightly because the film was going to be made very cheaply, and therefore that weight of responsibility that corresponds to a film's cost was kind of absent in our case. We managed to make pleasure out of everything, even the knockbacks and the difficulties and so on. And one of the things that I most enjoyed as I was writing was remembering vividly how we turned obstacles into amusement, how we turned potential catastrophes into opportunities. And I don't think any of us had or will ever do anything that was so seamlessly strange and pleasurable again.
And the fact that you actually appear in the film as well, or a part of you does.
Yes, indeed. And I also have a photograph, which I would hesitate to put up to the screen, of me in drag with you know, really kind of beautiful legs, and in the middle of the desert, that is. Because when we did the location survey, the cinematographer and Stefan Elliott, the writer-director, and I took some drag with us because we thought that if we came across a really great location and we wanted to bring back evidence of that really great location, what more persuasive evidence could there be than three guys in drag? So we took it and we found the spot towards the end of our recce in Alice Springs, and we slipped into our outfits in the middle of nowhere. But the middle of nowhere, thankfully, was quite near a road. And then when Brian Breeny, the cinematographer, had set up a shot on his wide lux camera, we then stopped a passing vehicle, and this completely bewildered backpacker emerged, and we just said, press that shutter when I get back to that hill over there. And sure enough, we ended up with this absolutely wonderful photo of the three of us without any actors yet, even notionally in the film, who represented the movie. I don't think there's been any greater symbolic engagement from a producer, a cinematographer, and a writer-director than being the characters just for the sake of showing people.
yeah, this is the spirit of it. You know, these aren't going to be the actual actors, but this is what it's going to feel like. And of course, you take that to Cannes, and one of the delights of reading your book is to see another side of Cannes, because I visit Cannes as a journalist and as a critic and interviewing people and what have you. But seeing it from your side as a producer who's going there to sort of set up a project like Priscilla, and then bring a project, a film, to the festival. It's a really exciting sort of backstage view of the festival.
Yeah. Well, we were lucky because the first time we went to Cannes with it, it was just mentioned as a footnote, because Stefan's first film, Broads, which was produced by my wife, Andrina Finlay, was in competition. But already Priscilla was starting to cook. And so we had an opportunity of mentioning it then. But by the time we got to Cannes before we started shooting the film. We already had Polygram on board. Polygram was a very, very important European film entity at the time, as well as being, you know, all the other things that people know. And they enabled us to have the kind of profile that a low-budget movie normally doesn't get there. We, you know, we financed the trip a bit ad hoc, but we knew that once we got there, they would look after us, as it were, and they did. So the preparation for the film, the casting of it, the kind of absurd kind of dance that existed when we were casting Jason Donovan and or Rupert Everett and so on, was all conducted in circumstances in which we were quite secure. We felt that the film was going to be made, that Polygram would finance it or part finance it. And so that anxiety, which usually corrodes an independent producer at Cannes, was absent in our case because we felt very grounded. And again, the spirit of fun eclipsed the spirit of anxiety.
And that went all the way through, so that when you're actually presenting the film, there's a brilliant story about there's an inflatable Arnold Schwarzenegger and you want to dress him in drag, like go out in the middle of the night and dress him up.
Well, it was just, there was so much mischief in the air, and we just felt as if we could really enjoy ourselves, and that in a way, the how well we made the film might be dependent on keeping this kind of buoyancy in motion. And so it proved to be, because when we eventually got around to it, whilst it was difficult in all the usual ways and many unusual ways as well, it was that spirit never left it.
Absolutely. I love the story that you say of Stefan keeping the cameras rolling while there's a costume malfunction in the opening number, and that sort of stays in the film. It's not meant to be there, but it works perfectly. It's kind of like a superb introduction to the characters and the situation.
It was really everything just came together in a remarkable way that is as everyone with a test, very unusual in the film business. Even the ABBA tunes that we used, that was a last minute thing as well, because Polygram had just signed them, and suddenly access became very possible in order just to ask, because they had been for quite some time such a huge band. And, you know, not everyone got a chance to ask them anything.
Yeah, but in a way, I mean, Priscilla was kind of ahead of the wave, because the stratospheric sort of heights of their sort of re-emergence was not upon us yet. You know, we Mamma Mia was far in the future.
Well, Mamma Mia had already been a hit once, but what wasn't known until Priscilla was the fact that, as you put it, and there was another wave of ABBA to come.
Yeah.
They weren't around or anything, you know. It wasn't, you know, Benny, what did you think of that take? None of that, I can assure you.
I imagine they would have been scared to be around, because they would have been able to go to the toilet without a worry that someone was going to pop in and jar a memento.
Yeah. That is my contribution to the script. I'm immensely proud of, which was a story that I had heard, and occasionally you can tell a story when you're, you know, driving around a country just exploring, and it can set the imagination alight. And the story was one that I had heard about somebody who, when ABBA were in Australia previously, they did a tour here in the 1970s, that there was some kind of a boat cruise in Perth, And one of the guests, a young man, had gone into the toilet as Agnetha came out of it, and discovered that, as the film put it, she had left a little present for him. and he bottled it and had it on his mantelpiece. That is fan craziness.
Yeah, absolutely. Like a relic of a saint.
Yes, exactly.
A piece of the true cross. And you said earlier about Mad Max becoming a franchise, but Priscilla kind of becomes a franchise because the spin-off musicals go all the way, you know, continue to this day. The effect that the film has, and it's even more remarkable when one of the notes you receive before the film is released is, could you cut out the songs?
Yes, yeah, pretty much so. It was that was a tough part on maintaining our sense of humor, but thankfully we did, and at the same time as we were maintaining a very firm resistance to being persuaded to do something wrong, and there were a couple of suggestions in that realm. And we resisted absolutely. And of course, once you've, the business then, and possibly still now, sanctifies successful test screenings. Mm. And until you've got the film in a state in which it's possible to test screen it and deliver to an audience what they're accustomed to hearing, because they're not accustomed to hearing a film with, you know, partial sound and silent scenes that are supposed to be noisy and so on. So there's a, during the time that you're editing a film and haven't yet shown it to the public, there is a lot of potential for argument about what works and what doesn't. Mm. And only when you've got the film to a standard where you're confident it can make the kind of impact that it should, can you do that. And we did. And it was all our ideas turned out to be reinforced by the audience's reactions.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's always the case.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With something quite as unique as that film, because to hear the log line, you know, at that period when nothing like that had been seen really, would be difficult. But at the same time, you kind of had to race a rival Hollywood production, because there was another film sort of in the works.
Yes, it was in the works for a while, so it didn't come out immediately after. That was To Wong Fu, Thanks for Everything, Julie Newmar. And it came and it went. I think that Priscilla by then had kind of established itself in a universe of one, basically.
Yeah. Absolutely. So what, following the success of Priscilla, your position in the Australian film industry was somewhat, you know, was solidified, and you know, you had several films at your back. How did you go about sort of choosing projects to continue with and to further?
I just decide what I feel I'd like to do next, and then set about trying to do it.
Right.
It's a very primitive, borderline crude philosophy, because certainly these days, which is where life is much more corporate and producers seem to proliferate everywhere you look, it's probably a little more difficult. But I kind of can only plow one field at a time, really. And that's what I did. And the film that I wanted to do afterwards, which I was approached about, was a movie called Heaven's Burning. I think basically I wanted to work my way around all the deserts in Australia. And that was a different desert. And this time it was Russell Crowe and Yuki Kudo. And then I went back to a different desert for Siam Sunset, which was the first film directed by the well-known actor in Australia, John Paulson. So I became Al, King of the Desert, briefly. But I just was looking for getting deeper and deeper into the country, I think, and trying to find out how Australia worked.
And of course, with Heaven's Burning, you're back working again with Russell Crowe, but here the relationship begins to sour, specifically in when you're doing the publicity for the film.
Yes, No, it was fine before. I mean, my conviction is that the earlier you meet in people's lives, the more likely you are to have a good relationship or a long one, because there's more time in which to have one, but also you, in doing so, you meet at a time before your lives have become more complicated, and therefore you're more open to each other. And with Russell on The Crossing, that was very much the case. We were all kind of finding each other for the first time. But by the time he did Heaven's Burning, he had made several American movies, The Quick and the Dead, and I think Virtuosity. And he had just finished L.A. Confidential. He had agreed to do Heaven's Burning before he started L.A. Confidential. And I think by the time he finished L.A. Confidential, he was already getting offers to do American pictures, which would have been to his benefit, probably. But we needed him for our film, and he had agreed to be in it, and so on. So he did. I mean, he just, you know, he came exactly when he was supposed to. But it was a difficult experience for him, I think, because he was probably speaking to his agent most days and hearing about what it was that they wanted him for next, and so on. And for us, it was difficult just because I think, you know, his professionalism was unswerving, but his heart was kind of pining for what he'd left behind. The so-called falling out, it was a falling out, really. It was simply that he was at a time when our film needed his support. He was quite kind of muted about it. And I understand why, I accept why, but it was a great irritant at the time.
You kind of want him to be on a publicity sort of at least not doing any harm to the movie, at least not dismissing it.
And I don't know. I mean, these are complaints that I heard from the distributors. So it wasn't. I wasn't present. I just knew that it wasn't right and that it diminishing us. But anyway, these things happen. And he went on, as we all know, to a fantastic series of performances, some of them really exceptional.
Yeah, absolutely. One of his films, which isn't as celebrated as I feel it should be, and one of his best performances is in Michael Mann's The Insider. I think that film is...
Well, that kind of lit the touch paper, as it were. It was remarkable because he was transformed. I mean, and he felt as if he belonged in that kind of film, as indeed he did in L.A. Confidential, and in what he did, you know, for several years after that.
And so you go on and you make a series of films which are have varied success. You know, there are some which are greeted by the public with more success than others, it's fair to say. Siam Sunset with Linus Roach, Eye of the Beholder with young Ewan McGregor and Ashley Judd just before... Yep. I think that's done about the same time as Phantom Menace, just before the Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Yeah, he came out here not that long after to do it.
And then you get to Chopper, which I think is a sort of fascinating film that you're involved with, because it sort of represents maybe a new... I don't know, maybe I'm not confident in saying this because I don't know enough about the Australian film environment, but it feels like Andrew Dominik comes on as a sort of new wave of talents. You know, there's he's coming on, David Michaud is coming on a little bit later, and suddenly you've got a real energy again returning to sort of Australian film.
Yes, I'm always looking for things that come alive in my imagination, and Chopper did. And when I met Andrew, that reinforced it, because I could see that what he aspired to do was different from a conventional crime movie. I mean, he had a way of describing Chopper and describing the things he did and the reasons that he might do something unexpected. It's curious how with films you really have to spend anything between a few months and a few years, and the only things you can really devote yourself to are the things where you can kind of anticipate that the journey is worth making. It's not that you're prescient about exactly how it's going to turn out. All you know is that the ride is one that engenders curiosity and just demands your attention. And that's the barometer, really, for anyone who doesn't make decisions simply opportunistically.
As a producer, was it in any way sort of dispiriting to see these great talents who you work with in Australia then sort of get picked up by, you know, go off to Hollywood and make, you know, and make great work, but kind of it's almost like you're a feeder club in that Manchester United keep taking your best players at the end of every season?
No, because I know how the world works.
Right.
And the world works on expanding your universe within it.
Yeah.
And so it follows that people will at the very least consider opportunity when it's merited. If I, you know, were offered the assassination of Jesse James, and I had, you know, Andrew's visual talent, I would have said yes as well.
Absolutely, yeah, that's one of my favourite films. I'm not going to complain about that at all.
Yeah, well, as an admirer of Terrence Malick, as I know you to be, it's very, you know, Malikian.
Yeah, yeah. Apparently, okay, this is my little bit of insider Terence Malick knowledge. Apparently, Malick gave notes to Andrew about the about Jesse James, about the assassination of Jesse James, and the note was lose the voiceover. I'm not joking either. which is sort of like it might come as a surprise, but his notes to collaborators were always kind of don't make a Terrence Malick film. I make the Terrence Malick film. You make something else.
Yes. Yeah, but it's anyway, it's a beautiful film, and I, you know, I can understand why it had limited commercial success, but it's just a kind of, it just seems boundary free. The boundaries are just those created entirely by its makers, and none of them are created by artificial considerations.
And in this period, even though you're obviously you're based in Australia, you're traveling a lot. You're going to festivals. You're taking films to festivals. You're taking films around the world to get financing and to set up projects. This seems also to be sort of like one of the themes of your book, is that you're constantly trying to balance your personal life, your family life, your children, and your projects, the artists who you're trying to bring forth their vision.
Yeah, it's a tightrope walk that you know in advance is going to be one. And the most important thing is not to be unsettled by it. I mean, so much energy goes into lament and regret in what we do. But if you pay attention to your family and you pay attention to jobs that need to be done, there is a kind of surprising symmetry and rightness about what you choose to do at that moment. I've never found it troublesome at all. I just thought whatever needs to be done that's my job should get done. And that's it, really. I find it very difficult to discuss producing for that reason, because I have a very simple-minded approach to it, which is if it needs doing, make sure it happens.
Yeah, the way to Moscow is to go to Moscow.
Precisely.
Looking at the Australian film industry now, how do you feel about it? How do you feel the present state of affairs is?
Well, I think that it's adventurous. At times, I mean, Australia has always produced a number of films every year that really take you by surprise.
Right.
I mean, I always remember in Cannes in 1996, seeing the first film by the sadly late Shirley Barrett, Love Serenade, and I felt I was in the presence of something I'd never seen before. The elements were familiar, the setting, the pitching of the lead performances, its eccentricity, its rhythm, and so on. But I was just so taken by its incredible charm and good nature, and also its darkness, you know. And that has always seemed to me the prototype of the kind of film that I would cherish more in from Australians. I realize, you know, that not everybody wants to make that film, and that they will want to make some other kind of film. But what I always champion is idiosyncrasy and something that is kind of all eclipsingly personal.
How do you think that compares to the British film industry that you, of course, you know, you're instrumental in shaping to some degree in the 70s and 80s? How does that Do you, because it does seem to me that what you just said is absolutely true, that the every year we have a handful of Australian films which are really striking and surprising and transfer, you know, they go international. With British films, I sort of always feel a little bit less, that there seems to be more of them and they're more, there's a broader range perhaps, but those films that really stick out sort of don't seem to be, or maybe I'm just, it's the contempt of familiarity.
Well, it's also the fact that we don't see everything that comes out of the UK, and you probably don't either. And what we do see naturally affects our perception of the whole thing. I suspect there are you know, nooks and crannies where remarkable things are being done there, but like you, I don't see much evidence of it. The films that I see feel that, well, historically, of course, there's been a much longer relationship between the UK and the US. So the American actors, for example, would favour probably a so-called quirky British film over its Australian counterpart. I know Australia is a rising star, or so we hear year after year. But I think the as I say, the history and the geography of the US and the UK means that there is a much more fluid relationship there. And yes, I think the further away you are from the availability of instant star power, the more significant and important it is for you to concentrate on doing original work. We're always struck by that. And the more films we see, the more struck we are by original work.
Yeah, absolutely. I think as well, in this time of television, where there are so many more stories out there being told in so many more original and interesting ways, kind of cinema has to up its game. It has to, you know, otherwise it will just become a fairground of franchises.
Yeah, I'm also a little disturbed, increasingly disturbed by the absurd number of producers on film. It really is absurd. No matter how small the film, it just, the producing credits are endless. And so I wonder, unless everybody has a completely different role, how many people can make up a production team, or whether they actually ever meet. Possibly they have, you know, Zoom calls going in, you know, 30 different directions. But I know that, you know, people who put money into films now expect such acknowledgement and so on. But why can't it just describe what it was, which was financed by? I find it remarkable and rather dispiriting that you get one director, but you get up to 45 producers of different some of whom never meet.
Oh, absolutely. I think there's a law in Hollywood that if Steven Spielberg walks past you, your project is executive produced by Steven Spielberg at that point. You know,
it's just, it's so bizarre. And I know, you know, historically film has always moved in phases, but this is a phase of serious overcrowding in the production department.
So, having written the two volumes of your memoirs, what surprised you the most? Sort of looking back, did you have any sort of surprises of things that you hadn't really realized, but now looking back in this way, it stood out?
No. I what occurred to me was that I did pretty much everything that I wanted to do. And what an extraordinary thing to be able to say and feel when your stamina is diminishing a little and your desire to do it repeatedly is more questioned by you. And so it's curious. I can't think of anything that I would have done any differently. This is a sign of either wisdom or comprehensive ignorance.
But how do you, how the two often look incredibly similar.
Yes. So it would appear. But I search in vain. I'd love to. I wish I'd been prepared for that, because there is a potentially great answer to that. I think my favorite one, I can't remember the film in question, but a director was asked once what he would do if he had his whole life to live over again. And without hesitation, he said, I'd do everything exactly the same, except I wouldn't have made and then named the film.
Right. There's just one film. That's
one film, that's right. Yeah. But it was, it felt quite prepared, and I would hesitate to single out anything that I hadn't wanted to do, because I wanted to do them.
Yeah, you wanted to do them for the right reasons, no matter how they turned out.
Yeah. Well, and I was confident that they would turn out in a way that was, whilst not exactly the way I envisaged them, in a way that in some cases was even more interesting.
And what about now? Have you got any projects that you are sort of dabbling in or putting together?
No, I'll know it when I see it. But right now, I'm completely concerned with making sure that my books are read, and that my neglected family is given much more of my attention in the form of a holiday we're going to take imminently. And that, 3-4 decades of continuous work are rewarded by variety and pleasure and care.
And you still you're still it takes me back to the very beginning of your first memoir, where you're going to the cinema in Spain to watch your to escape. You still pop in the cinema for that same feeling?
Yeah, well, we live very near a cinema in Sydney, the Randwick Grits, which is absolutely extraordinary for me, whose boundaries are boundless, because it shows films of all nationalities. It'll show something that hardly anybody wants to see once a day. So just to make sure that whoever does want to see it goes to see it, or has the option of doing so. And it's at any given time, it's showing two or three things that interest me. It's an amazing blessing to have the proximity of a cinema as one of the proximity of a good cinema that knows how to program well in one's roaming territory.
Yeah, in one's vicinity, absolutely. It's like you need a good bakery, a good butcher's, and a great cinema, and a good bookshop. Sure. And a good bookshop, of course.
Yes, yes.
That's my village sorted.
Yes.
Well, listen, Al, thank you so much for talking to me once more. It's been a wonderful conversation over these two conversations, really. I've really enjoyed reading your books. I encourage everybody to do so. It's just a fascinating life. Real privilege to talk to you.
A great pleasure for me, too.
On a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.